problems we didn't anticipate from that study were caused.
Yes, definitely. But some people think that's an advantage. I would list the creation of the suburbs as a disadvantage of the automobile, but some people see it differently. I think antibiotics is sort of almost the perfect example of this, because I think everyone would agree we know what problem antibiotics solve, and we know that it solves it for almost everybody, but at the same time, it weakens what we call our immune system. So that creates a new problem created by solving an old problem.
Is there a problem for which that is the solution? Are people having a hard time hearing in the back?
Very good.
No, so what is the problem? I don't know. Would this magnify my voice? Yes. Do you all hear me? So, see? And if that had cost me money to do, then it would be especially wise for me to say, Jonathan remembers last time I was here, I did talk about this Honda, this car I bought. I don't know if you remember, I went to buy what is the model, a Honda?
Accord,
thank you. Honda Accord. So the salesman says it has cruise control, for which, of course, there's an extra charge. What did I ask him? Good. Not watch cruise control. I knew what cruise control was.
Does it have rust-proofing, too?
No. I said, what is the problem to which cruise control is the solution? Well, he said no one had actually asked him that before, but he thought for a minute, and he said it's the problem of keeping your foot on the gas. So I said I'd been driving for 35 years, and I'd never found this to be a problem. He said, you know, this car has electric windows. I said, what is the question I asked him?
What is the problem?
Oh, good. I thought you were going to say, I asked him, what are electric windows? So I asked him that question, and he was ready for me this time. He said, oh, it's the problem of not having to do this, or even worse, this. So I said, well, you know, I'm an academic. I live a sort of sedate life. Any little exercise I can get is all I retain. Now, here's the punchline, in a way. I bought the Honda with the cruise control, which, by the way, I've never used since I got it. But with the cruise control and with electric windows, because you can't get this car without those things. So that's sort of an interesting point, because many people say new technologies widen our options, and sometimes they do, but sometimes they also close off options. You know, they can widen and they can close. Sometimes they do both. They open a new option and close off another one. So I'm not a neo-Luddite, and I'm not anti-technology. My whole thing is just to raise questions about the role that technology plays in our lives and in our culture, and by doing that, try to get some control over it. Finally, before I invite you in, which I'm anxious to do, when I've been at New York University for a long time, actually, Jonathan, if I live another, what is today, November?
7th.
Today's the 7th? No, see.
I was relying on my watch.
Yeah. by the way, in 1750, Rousseau threw away his watch
And I found it.
Yes. He said, thank heavens, I'll never have to know what time it is again. Well, whenever the year 2000 comes, once it's about 40 days or so, if I make it to then, I will have been at New York University for 6 decades. Because my first class was in February of 1959. Then my math skills have deteriorated as I've gotten older. But I think that's 6 decades, isn't it? 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, and 2000. When I first got to NYU, it was fairly primitive, technologically speaking, I mean, by today's standards. Students could read, they could write, they were pretty good listeners and the speakers, and the same for the professors. As for sort of audio-visual machinery, there was very little. By the way, students still could write their papers in longhand, many typed on Smith Coronas, but it was not objectionable to hand in a paper that was written in, as we said, longhand. Occasionally, a professor would show a film, but it always broke. The projector always broke, and you learn pretty quickly plan to have it break and so on. So now NYU is pretty up to date technologically. As a matter of fact, John, when I was in New York class, not the lecture, but what was that class?
Internet Society.
Yeah, and all the students had these machines out. Remember when it started? And it was very scary. Suddenly, all these things came in front of the desk. I didn't know what it was. I thought it was dangerous. But at NYU, too, you have all this stuff. The latest, and everyone has a computer except me. I asked myself, all right, let me be fair here. Now, let's compare the way I remember it back in 1960 with what it is now. Are the students smarter? Do they have more knowledge? Do they write better? Do they read better? Are the teachers better teachers? Are their books more interesting? Are the conversations more substantive? So I try to ask my, because NYU, like the Harvard, has probably spent $1 billion on all this shit. Oh, what did I say? On all this stuff. So it's a fair question, isn't it? If you make an investment like this, are we better off in some sense? So I ask those key questions because that sense was especially important to me. Do people read, write better, think, do they make more perceptive comments in class, and so on. And I came to the conclusion, no, the teachers are not better teachers. Their books are not more interesting, not better written. Their conversations are a little less interesting because now about, oh, maybe 15% of the conversations are about the technology that they've used. Whereas in the earlier period I'm talking about, I mean, what could you say about a pen? Does it have ink? And that's the end of the conversation. But now a lot of time is taken up talking about which computer is better and so on. So that's not so interesting. But the students, they're not dumber, definitely not, although they have less knowledge in their heads. I mean, they carry around less knowledge, although they claim they have quicker access to knowledge if they need it, but they're less sure about what knowledge they need, which, you know, is the downside of that. So I've come to the conclusion that they're not much after $1 billion investment and all of this celebration of the new world, we're not, at least where I am, very much better off. In fact, I think we're like 2 yards back from where we were. So if this be an anti-technology person, then I will plead guilty. But I don't think of myself that way, just someone who is tries to be thoughtful about what this is doing to us and whether it makes us better or worse. Incidentally, the same argument Rousseau brought up in 1749, when he wrote the famous essay, or the essay that made him famous, in which he asked if scientific, he was not just talking about technological knowledge, but scientific knowledge and technological knowledge made us more moral. Did it corrupt our morals or enhance our morals? And he concluded, of course, that it corrupted, but not very necessarily agree with him there. But it's the sort of question I think we have to ask to have a serious dialogue, especially if you're going to spend billions of dollars. Because I'll give you an example. 2 years, there are 1,100,000 children in the New York City school system. 2 years ago, on the first day of school, when the children showed up, 90,000 of them did not have seats. You hear what I'm saying? There were no seats for 90,000 children. And many of these children had to meet their classes, I'm talking about even first and second and third graders, in the bathrooms. Now, this is a school system that is seriously considering spending hundreds of millions of dollars or more on wiring each classroom to the internet. So tell me where I'm wrong here. Have I missed something? Would I be a Luddite, hopeless reactionary if I said I wouldn't spend a goddamn nickel on a computer until every kid had a seat? Would you go along with me there, or have I missed something? So, yes. Yeah, but meanwhile, we have the kids in the bathroom. Yeah, I mean, try to keep that image in mind, that you have almost 90,000 kids sitting on the floor in a bathroom, and then someone says, well, maybe we can network them long or distance learning. Well, that's possible, maybe in the future. Maybe schools themselves will become obsolete. But that's down the road. Right now, we have a budget to pass. Now, if I'm representing, if I'm at the budget meeting, I say to the Board of Education, I don't want you guys to spend 5 cents on anything until you make sure the kids don't have to go to class in the bathroom.
I was in high school and I was preferred to be.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. If you were smoking there, that's okay. That's all right. But I don't know about the first and second and third graders, if they were interested in, and I don't think they liked it very much.
But go out on a limb, right? I mean,
yeah.
Nobody is going to stand up here and say we should have kids have to meet in the bathroom while we spend our money on computers,
right.
Unless it was buy one computer, get three chairs free, which suddenly I could see would be an attractive deal for the computer manufacturers.
Well, I think, Jonathan, you're right. No one states it that way. But at budget meetings, people are saying, well, we're going to invest this much money in what they call the future. And we're going to wire the classrooms. And a lot of people don't make a connection between that kind of expenditure, that policy decision, and the fact that there's just not enough seats for the children.
Suppose at that meeting, Bill Gates send the letter. You might not have heard of him, but he has something to do with computers.
Gay.
Yep.
The monopolist.
Yeah, yeah, you've got him.
Okay.
But this is his BillGates.org wing. This is his charitable wing. And his foundation says, we are delighted to be able to give you $5 million for the purchase of computers and wires, and your school can have it. It's above and beyond whatever your budget already has, and that's all it can be used for. Simply sign here, we'll send you the check, and that's that. Now, is that a happy occasion at your meeting?
Yeah, although I ask him, I say, Bill, you're very generous. How could we use $1 million of it to replace some worn-out texts or books we have, storybooks for second graders? Would that be all right, Bill?
You say fine. It's good. Overhead, they call it.
We got a deal.
All right.
Yes.
Well, I mean, the problem, I'm not going to argue that there's a point on the computers versus, like, people and kids. The problem is you can always make that argument at every level. I mean, we shouldn't be spending any money learning the lobby when the children start in Africa. I mean, as long as there's someone out there suffering in somewhere, there's always a review of education. There's always a company. At some point, you have to stop the tower, and, you know, those are the problems, so we can't afford to
fight
those and to be left behind.
No, I don't think that's a fair point, if I may say it. May I say it?
Sure.
Well, let me try to say why I don't think it is. Because I'm talking about the same context. I mean, I'm not talking about wiring classrooms as against feeding children in some East African country. I'm talking about the process of schooling them and just simply asking you to address this issue. What would be the priorities that you would list in spending money to school children? That's all.
So, the problem is there's always a difficulty in distributing resources, whether
correct.
It's, you know, between here in Africa or within the New York City school system. I mean,
yeah, but
inequities have always existed.
That's true. But I mean, I'm just asking about this. We're at a Board of Education meeting, and we're addressing the question of how we would allocate the limited resources we have towards educating our children. I realize your point about there are always people starving someplace. I remember my mother had a great thing when I didn't finish eating something. You probably heard that too. You know, there are children starving in...
Where were they starving?
Yeah, they're starving in Asia, I think, or... No, maybe Europe. And then it always occurred to me, if I didn't eat this, or if I ate it, they wouldn't be starving, you know. But I'm just talking about this limit. Yes, but in the back.
I was a little scared when you accepted the deal here with you today.
Oh, good.
Because the question is, even if you have all the money in the world for education, what do you want computers being used for? And are they being used in ways that create more problems at times to be solved? And are there other times when the same computer creates more problems than they create?
Thank you. Mr. Gates, I want to take back the deal.
Everybody saw the handshake. I'm sorry.
But you should sue me now, and maybe you will finally win a case. Yes. Here's the thing. It's a good question. I was too quick to accept the deal. I think you're generous to allow me to use $1 million to buy some books. But I really wanted, is it up to me to decide how to use this technology, or are you going to decide for me?
I think you're the best person to decide it. Exactly as you describe yourself, as a critic, not in the sense of just dumping on something, but a critic as in a food critic who appreciates food and can distinguish between good food and bad food, I want you to be a technology critic, and I'll give you the money, and I don't want you to say nothing more complicated than a pen will be in my
Is this all right with you?
Well, are you going to be using them in a way that helps the kids or not? Or is this very exciting little box going to be a great toy? But in the end, it's like...
But he's going to leave it up to us. Well, right.
Yes, and there's particularly little risk with him. He doesn't seem charmed by the boxes.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not charmed. I like that, Jeff. I'm not charmed by boxes. I'm going to ask your help and the help of some other people who know something about children, who know something about the computers. And before we even take them out of the boxes, we're going to have some very thoughtful meetings. Maybe it'll take us a year to figure out exactly what we want these things to do. And then we'll let Mr. Gates know. We may say, you know, we're going to leave them in the boxes. And maybe he wouldn't be too happy about that. Yes, and then you, but I think yes.
Well, I'll try to make this relevant to the other questions that have been raised.
Very unusual.
Educating our society, perhaps, or humankind.
Right.
What is your opinion of NASA and the space program and their impact on sort of American and first?
Well, NASA and the space program. Well, okay. Well, I have to be very cautious about my answer to that because my oldest son, Mark, is an astrophysicist. He works at the Hubble Space Center. If he was sitting in the audience and I said anything against this, I hear about it for years, but he's not here. So here's what one of the things I like about the space program. And maybe this takes us off the topic a little bit, maybe it doesn't, is that I think we Americans are in desperate need of some new transcendent narratives, ideas. I call them the stories, great stories, that will help to give meaning to our lives and give us a sense of purpose and continuity. We used to have some wonderful stories, which I think are waning in their power.
You're not talking about science fiction, are you?
I am now, but I mean, I was about to mention some other story. They're all fiction in a way, they're myths. America as the moral leader of the world. It's a great story. People in other countries don't always appreciate it, but it's been very powerful for Americans. That revolution we created here had the authority of the divine behind it. You know, these
It
does, yes, indeed. But great things, too. Anyway, it's a powerful story. The melting pot story, also one that has its downside. But the idea that America is the place where people of different races and religions and backgrounds can come and live in harmony and peace. I mean, that's an American story. Well, the Protestant ethic, the best way to earn God's favor is to deny yourself everything. Work hard, never have a good time, and then you'll enter into God's grace. Another thing about the story. Now, what I like about NASA, because you're wondering, what the hell is this guy talking about? here's what I like about it. That I think one of the burgeoning narratives has to do, it goes something like this, that we are all crew members on the spaceship, the Earth spaceship, irrespective of where you come from, doesn't matter. We're all together on this spaceship. And whatever happens in one part of the spaceship, if the forests in Brazil are disappearing, it's of concern to people in Cambridge, Massachusetts, because it's all the same spaceship. This is an emerging new story. I like it. I like the fact that Steven Spielberg has become one of the tellers of this tale, not only in E.T., but that earlier, what was that? Close Encounter of the Third Kind, that Americans are beginning to spin this tale, this narrative. And so I like that idea.
Mission to Mars.
What?
Mission to Mars.
Love that idea. Because it's mythic. It's something I think we need. A story about where we stand in the universe. Especially since, as Nietzsche said, God is dead. I don't know if that's true. Although he did say, and I think this is true, without God, everything is permissible. So if that is so, we need some other kind of God. And I think the idea that we are stewards of the earth, we're just on our own spaceship, and that you call it science fiction, but I think you meant that ironically. It's more than that, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, what about a myth that involves, you know, it may become a reality, that involves connecting every human mind to every other human mind? If you just say the collective organism of mind.
I mean,
using technology to do this.
Yeah. Well,
the nervous system for the whole species.
Yeah. Now, if you're suggesting that that machine does that, then we would have to have a long conversation.
I think it might.
Yeah, I know.
Doing it.
I know. That's why we have to have a long conversation. Now, yes.
I just wondered about this sort of faith affirming. One thing that struck me when I met in San Jose, the mayor of the State Museum in Washington, is that they have this little section where they have these stamps commemorating and what's striking about it is there are stamps from like over 100 different times, including Tony Jackson, so clearly they have other problems to avoid. And I view the space program no different than art in general and sports. It gives us, I mean, sort of in mind what we're saying, but more, it's something that this kind of gets back to what we're talking about with computers in the school in a sense, in that at some level, you have to sort of look past this problem and sort of give yourself something to shoot for. And I mean, that's why we go and watch, you know, we listen to music, and like our teachers in the gate, it gives us something to shoot for. And at that level, you can't just get back and all the time you promise to deal with. Well, at some point, you have to look in the future, you have to look something that transcends your sort of everyday existence. I think the space program is a wonderful company for no other reason than that. I mean, when we land on Mars, that's something where everyone all over the world, has some.
Yes. I agree with you. But I think you're making the point, tell me if I'm wrong about this, that, you were making the point that investing in millions and millions of dollars in, say, wiring classrooms is some kind of investment in the future, and we might have to look past this immediate problem of kids in the bathroom, right? Is that
at some level? I mean,
yeah.
And, you know,
right.
There are programs where inner-city kids, you know, get on the internet and about this stuff. But at some level, it's an escape from.
All right. Well, there might be a point to what you're making that we might, but there would be still some other questions we'd ask. For example, if we're going to ignore those kids sitting in the bathroom, we probably should have a very serious conversation about why we're ignoring them. What is it that we're shooting for here that will give us something very rich in the future, so that in the end we have to say, we're really sorry you had to sit there, but we actually did something significant here. So then we have to discuss exactly what we're doing here. Now, two summers ago, a fellow named Oppenheim, I think, you could check it out because you have your computers. It was in the Atlantic, I don't think it's called the Atlantic Monthly anymore, is it? The Atlantic, and it was in the summer 2 years ago, so you can get it, and his name was either Oppenheim or Oppenheimer, I can't remember. He did an article in which he surveyed almost every example of computer use in schools. Not everyone, but a very representative sample. And then asked the question, is there any evidence that kids are getting smarter in any sense from this? Now, his conclusion, and it was a very substantial study, but I mean, there could be others later on that will find different things, is that basically you accomplished one thing if you had PCs in classrooms. Kids learn how to use computers. But if you asked, do they know history better, philosophy better, or science better, or any other subject, do they read better, write better, the answer is a resounding no. So that raises another issue. Since about 45 million Americans already have figured out how to use computers without any help whatsoever from the schools, if the schools did nothing in the next 10 years, we could be pretty sure most people will have figured out how to do this, the way everyone learned how to drive without any help from the schools. But, I mean, that's what I mean. We'd have to have a serious conversation, because you're making a very powerful point. You're leaving these kids.
Todd Oppenheimer, the computer delusion.
Yeah, what is it?
Todd Oppenheimer, the computer delusion.
Todd Oppenheimer, the computer delusion. No. But I want him to look at it. Anyway, I'm sorry I missed you. You don't mind it. Yes.
I just wanted to maybe try and link together the Earth and spaceship.
Spaceship, yeah.
Backwards, I know before about the education policy. And that is it. There's a big difference between the space program and the educational question, because you have to recognize that the reality is it was America with the educational policies who made it a really local level. And so, you know, the issues that are in the people's minds are making decisions and put them in the center of the internet schools. If not, it's just going to take us on spaceship Earth to a greater place. It's going to be, are my kids keeping up with kids down the street? Are they going to be as competitive in the airports? They're not centralized decisions, really, so people aren't going to be thinking in that manner.
I know a couple here's an interesting question. Someone just brought this up yesterday. I was at a conference, and this is about technology, too. I do grant your point, but this just occurred to me. Someone was giving a talk against testing, you know, SATs and so on. And then someone said this, isn't this IQ testing and SAT testing, isn't this more democratic than older ways of determining who would enter school? And he was using Ivy League schools, but he had a lot of data there that there was a time. By the way, I think one of the little figures that popped up that I do remember is that 85% today of the Princeton undergraduate students do not qualify for any student loans or aid. because their parents make in excess of $300,000 a year. This is Princeton, which is sort of interesting, because someone was making the argument that to get into Princeton, Yale, probably was it that way at Harvard and the other Ivy League schools, you had to be rich, you had to have connections, you had to be part of a cultural elite. And the argument was being made, now along comes these technological means of measuring people's brain power, and isn't that, and that in theory is supposed to replace political and cultural power as a means of getting in, but it turns out it's not really doing that. But I mean, if it did that, would we consider that an advance in democracy? Say, look, we don't care where your parents come from, we're just going to give you this test. And those who score above a certain number will let in, and those others we let out. Well, it's very interesting discussion about that. Because then, and this sort of related to the point, I mean, you might say, yeah, that is a better way. But let's have a conversation about the test. And is the test doing what it says it's doing? Is it possible to quantify what we're talking about to begin with? Now, if we discover the test isn't doing that at all, then we've made a bad bargain. Might as well keep the other way of doing it, or find another way entirely. So there were a couple of people that I know on this, but
I
you keep
just,
talking.
You pretty much said okay. What?
No,
what? Okay.
What?
The testing is exactly, there's a lot of things wrong with it in general.
Yeah.
The question of technology education is a larger one, I think.
Yeah. You wanted to say something, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Not
that I see.
Yeah. Okay. So the thought was that the quality of technical education would allow them to get them fantastic. So we've got four or more external ways to watch all the
winners. Well, see, there is something, a very important idea that I think we should discuss. The function of speed in our lives. Even when I was in the fifth grade, I that's to tell you how really brilliant I am. I thought about this because I took one of these IQ tests, and you do it you get like a half hour for a certain section or 20 minutes, and I was doing great, and the teacher said, I read this question, and I was about to fill in the blank, and the teacher said, "Time's up." I could still hear her words ringing in my ear. "Time's up," and I filled it in. She went ballistic. She accused me of all sorts of awful things and said that the test now is invalid. And I remember I was in the fifth grade thinking, one of us is wacky. I knew the answer to this. And I didn't look at anyone else's paper. I put the answer in. So she said, "Time's up, big deal." She thought it was a big deal. Test makers think that's a big deal. So then I began to think, what is this thing about speed? Where is the connection? Who made the connection between the faster you could think about something, the better you are as a thinker? Where did that come from?
The Industrial Revolution.
All right. Yeah, I mean, you can begin to discuss this. Now, I know that's not exactly the question you're raising, but... Yeah, but I mean that idea of, you say, well, the kids will be able to do certain things faster, to be more convenient. Well, we have to say that could be so. I mean, that's one thing I didn't really look at. I didn't have the interest, I guess, that I should have, to find out, is your life more, is the word commodious? Is that a word? Yeah. I can tell you this. Let's to get away from kids for a minute, to grown-ups I know, that the new technologies have made their lives more frenetic, more frantic, more disorganized than ever. Now, I mean, you know, something that can start out as a great benefit to the human race could turn into a despot. People running around, they don't have a minute during the day. You know, someone, you mentioned to create the suburbs. So you see the mothers, most grief, and sometimes fathers, they're driving this child to the soccer game and that child someplace else, and then off to, and they don't have a minute to think. So when they look at the new technologies, they're not rejecting any of them, but they're saying this has made me a little nuts. Yeah.
Okay, I do think that efficiency are valuable technology. In fact, I think that's how a lot of the technology that's helped us come up with is directed from food production. And if you've done it less time and less manpower, it's a technological advantage. I think that the problem is not today, you know, people having that time today is not due to technology, but that has to do with the fact that technology is having their expectations. They expect to get a lot more done today using the technology that they supposedly make that easy to do. And instead of the expectations, they're constantly feeling pressure to do more than possible.
All right. Well,
technology has a problem with raising the expectations.
Yeah. Okay. And of course, so you, what you're saying is, in a way, it's not the technology, but the fact, the way people have allowed the technology to control their attitudes. Well, yes, of course. It's all a package. We have to think about it together. Take the great Protestant ethic, so-called, that I mentioned before, that the best way to earn God's favor is to be disciplined, to delay gratification. That's been changed. The best way to earn God's favor is to buy things. Just buy things. It doesn't matter what you buy, just buy. And God will reward you in the end. I think that's sort of the great American religion at the moment. Now, you can't say in a way, well, that's television that's done that. I mean, the technology itself, that would be foolish. But you could say the way we have used, do you know that the average American kid by age 20 will have watched in the neighborhood of 600,000 television commercials. Now, you wouldn't need to do a big time study to say if someone goes through the first 20 years of his or her life seeing 600,000 television commercials, each one, by the way, or maybe not each one, but most of them, being a kind of narrative, a story that has a real ideology inside it. Every problem is solvable. Every problem is solvable fast, and every problem is solvable fast through the use of some drug, some technique, some technology. Yeah, oh, listen. You just came in.
We were watching our screen before we came in.
Is this what you're talking about? No, that's all right. Yeah, we're running out of time.
No, actually, I had, I suppose we're running out of time, but I had a challenge I wanted to put to you, and separately a question I wanted to ask.
And what would that be?
The challenge
is... What would Jay be?
the challenge is, we've been talking so much about education and technology in particular today. One of the insights you had in your Technopoly book is the way in which technology is derived from technique, which is simply a repeated process that you realize being able to disengage your brain helps you out. You can just do this process, right, and it usually gets you where you want to go. And what is even a class in the absence of electricity, but the presence of a start time and a stop time, and we shall meet one day, Wednesday, Friday, and then there shall be a midterm, and then a, what is that but technology? That's a technique.
Absolutely.
And if you grant that, then it seems that the baseline you describe, NYU 1959, is as steeped in technology as NYU 1999. It's just different technologies. And if that's the case, then again, I put to you the Bill Gates question.
You must be a lawyer. Yeah, go on.
You must be a critic.
Yeah. I put it to you, Mrs. Carrick.
Isn't it true,
yes,
Nan, that the challenge for you then is to not get stuck or ossified in whatever technology has worked so well for you as a teacher or as a learner that you've embraced it and can see no easy better, but to see what's out there. And it's true that the people who have adopted it in the first round, and certainly the people who peddle it in the first round, are ones who are completely optimistic about its uses and careless about its applications. But that doesn't mean it has no use. I mean, we're in a room in which this is a highly teched up room since you were last in it, and one in which it's very subtle. But, you know, the blackboards spring up and screens are behind them, and there's a camera hidden up there. And
it is.
There's Ethernet in every jack, yeah. And some of the people in this room who are in it once a week as part of my class are joining in an experiment in which we try out different things. Some of them fail miserably and comically. Others are pretty interesting. And to have you on the forefront of testing this stuff out would be a benefit, both to yourself and to the enterprise.
There are a number of answers, Jonathan. One is, to some extent, I am ossified, to use your unkind.
Well, it was all hypothetical, of course.
I do, when it comes to new technologies. Remember I said at the beginning, I think some of those questions have application to a culture and should be part of the politics, the political dialogue of a culture. But also they are could be used individually. I mean, I do ask myself, personally, will this technology benefit me in some way? And if not, of course, I pass it over, but also ask, suppose it does benefit me in some way, what will be the cost? So, I mean, I do ask these questions. I don't have what is call waiting, because if I'm having a conversation with you, I was just brought up this way. It would be rude for me to say, Jonathan, there's someone else calling me now who might be more interesting than you. So I'm going to take that call.
But you do have a telephone.
I do.
And had the first implementation of the telephone been with call waiting because of the way they wired it? And the innovation in the late 90s was actually the busy signal. You'd adopt it.
But, okay, here's another point, John. In the Phaedrus by, well, Socrates, Plato's Phaedrus, this is Irving Plato. Okay. Socrates, who wrote no books, and if not for Plato and Xenophon, we know almost nothing about him, speaks against writing. This is not printing, this is the written word, phonetic writing. And he gives three reasons why he's against it. One is that if we write everything down, we'll lose our memory, which happened. Remember, the average Athenian youth of the time, before text, had to commit to memory all of the epic poetry. This is the Iliad and the Odyssey by memory. And that was just the beginning. Whereas you, who are the elite of American education, would collapse if you had to memorize Paul Revere's Ride. Does this mean you're dumber? No, of course not. At least so you will argue. Because you will say, if you want to know Paul Revere's Ride, I'm not going to memorize it. I'll go to the library and get it for you. But Socrates was worried that memories would decline in their power, which happened. He was worried that the concept of privacy would be wrecked, because he says, whenever you write something down, you never know whose eyes will fall on it and whose eyes will not. And then the third, which I'm sure you see every day in your classes, he says, it has a wonderful line, he says, writing forces a student to follow an argument rather than to participate in it. And whenever you see students busily taking notes, that's an example of it. So here's what I'm driving at, Jonathan. If I had been living in Mainz, Germany in 1456, and I heard about Gutenberg's invention, I would have been against it. Not against it. I would have said, listen, before we go ahead, you know, the first 50 years of the invention of the printing press with the movable type, over 8 million books were printed. This is like, this is, you want to talk about a revolution. You think computers are a revolution. Imagine the impact on culture where you go from a manuscript culture to a machine-made books. 8 million books on almost every conceivable subject. So if I had lived in Germany, I would have said in German, of course. Gutenberg, don't get excited here. Let's talk about this. I'm not against books. Gutenberg, do you realize, if you go ahead with this, because he's got an old wine press that he's working on, you go ahead with this. You may want to go ahead, but if you do, it's going to help bring down the Holy Roman See. And you're a devout Roman, well, Catholic, everyone was.
Let's give the Dark Ages a chance.
You're going to bring about a religious split in Europe that will cause more deaths than you could imagine. You want to go ahead with it. And he might say, well, he said, you can't bury it. Once someone, as a matter of fact, 7 different cities in Germany claim to be the birthplace of the printing press with movable type. And some of them have a better claim than Mainz and Gutenberg. But we just agree for simplicity's sake that it's Gutenberg. So maybe this was a meme, or whatever they call it, that new word.
An idea whose time has come.
Here's what I'm trying to say, John. You need people like me in the world. You know why you need people like me? Because you need people who say, not that they're against it, but before you commit yourself, your heart and your soul and your intellectual habits and your social life and your political ideas to the thrall of this new technology, let's have a conversation about it. I mean, look, if we had had a conversation, Jonathan, about the combustion engine in, say, 1910, it is just possible we could still have our cars, but we would not have sick in the air and sick in the cities and created the suburbs. The cities might still be vital places. We might have had our car, but prepared ourselves for it.
So this brings me to the question. I see Carlo wants to get in. Yeah. Let me ask you the question, and that is, you shown how a conscientious person might ask some questions, whether buying a Toyota or staring at a box of computers in a classroom, as to whether to make the personal decision to adopt the technology. You've even shown how an institution might collectively come to that decision, a school district or something like that. You've given one example of how a collective people can do so in the supersonic transport. That example, I think, has few companions because it's rare that the market is structured so there can be that deliberation. In the supersonic transport case, you had airports, you had permits. I mean, the government was all over it already, and the government had to make a decision. When you talk about the adoption of call waiting or the use of laptops generally.
But John, you know, there are other examples, like the whole environmental movement, which certainly has national implications, has aroused people's questions about affecting law, too, about what people would be permitted to do if there would be certain consequences for the environment.
So I guess my question is then, are you satisfied with the forums that exist right now within our polity to allow somebody like you or a would-be environmentalist to raise the alarm, get Congress going, get the culture going, and then maybe have a decision?
It's all right because, it's all right because 25, 30 years ago, you could draw a bigger crowd for a lecture if the topic was how to improve your backhand in tennis than you could on this subject. But now I think that's different. Parents have become aware of the impact of television on their children. The environmentalists have shown that every policy decision we make concerning technology, or almost everyone, has implications for the environment. Lawyers are involved. Academics are involved. Critics are involved. Even actors and entertainers are involved. So that I'm very happy, about the possibility that the questions we've been discussing here are being raised. People know about these things. They talk about it, and politicians now talk about it. Of course, Al Gore says the reason he's so much in favor of what is just generally called the information superhighway, it's sort of an abstract term, but is that we will have access, or we could have access, to 500 or 1,000 television stations. Well, I think we can ask Gore, is that a problem that most Americans yearn to have solved? Do you really think that the 50 or 60 we currently have access to are not enough to provide us with what we want? I mean, we can get into this conversation. I think we're doing all right. We were behind, we Americans, because of the adoration for technology. We just love technology and made the mistake of believing that technological innovation and human progress were exactly the same thing. And I think now we don't believe that, so we're beginning to talk about it. Even right up here in Harvard, which is always behind in talking about anything of importance. So I'm just thank you. I'm sorry.
Last word from Bob.
One other question that I'd like you to add to your list.
Okay.
It would be something where in spite of our parodied images, I think we could always agree about technology, which is does a new technology separate people or does it connect?
Great question.
And that would be an area where you and I could have a succession.
And we have to define what we mean by separate and what we mean by connect. Here's an interesting thing, just final. I thought of it. When new technologies come in, they frequently make old technologies obsolete. Sometimes completely obsolete, as in the case of the printing press, made manuscript culture obsolete. You have to go to a museum to see one now. Sometimes they just modify it all. Now, I would have thought that the invention of the machine-made book in the 15th century, and then, of course, a lot of texts in the 16th, would have made the lecture method in universities obsolete within 50 years. I mean, once the students have access to the same texts for a minimal, you know, economically feasible way, why do they need the professor to stand in the front of the room or whatever room it is, even this improved room, talking to people? Question. Why did this, would you agree 95% of the classes in American universities today, this is basically the structure? And it's obsolete, you say. So why has it survived for almost 500 years? It may be that there's something about it, about, in your question, separating, and be, or maybe, you know, young people need to
communicate a lot more by being Neil Postman than by sending a Neil Postman.
Well, okay, that's okay. But also, maybe they just need to be close to each other. I mean, maybe there's something, yeah, something like this, that so that helps this survive. I think the idea that people are asking questions like this is, it's not pervasive in the culture, not enough, but it's going, and I'm very happy, and I thank you all for allowing me into your August call.
So this conversation between Barlow and Postman, at least, will continue at 7 p.m. at the Sackler Gallery. It's only 5:15 right now, is that right? It's only 5:15. So it'll continue at 7 o'clock at the Sackler Gallery. I think you need tickets. If you don't have them, I have a couple extras. And if you don't have them even after that, I think they'll still let you in, but I can't guarantee it. It's just by the fire station, the Cambridge Fire Station, near the Science Center.
Yeah, you look familiar.
When you come up and Are you going to the bookstore to find?
Yes. Are you there now? NPR in preparation.